So to start off with, the Russian Revolution in 1917 was the most radical event in human history. It overthrew a barbaric, centuries-old Tsarist monarchy in a backward country of over 150 million people. It redistributed the lands of ancient feudal estates to millions of impoverished peasants. It ended the First World War and the senseless slaughter of up to 20 million people. And the Soviet government, pretty much as soon as it came into power, began implementing some pretty far-reaching reforms. There's way too many to actually go into here, but just for a taste of one particular issue they tried to deal with, the oppression of women. Women were granted full legal and political rights in the USSR. Women and men were given unrestricted right to marriage and divorce. So in other words, they could divorce and marry without any interference from the church or state at their own free will. Same-sex relationships and marriages were recognized. Illegitimacy was abolished as a legal concept, and paid maternity leave was granted before and after birth. Russia was the only country in the world at that time to guarantee women the free right to abortion on demand. Communal kitchens and childcare centers were set up to try and free women from the burdens of the family. And on top of that, you know, there were literacy programs that teachers set up. In fact, the education sector couldn't get started back up after the first year of the revolution because teachers were still debating about how they wanted education to be implemented. National minorities were granted the right to independence up to and including secession from Russia. And minorities were able to practice their own religions and speak their own languages, often for the first time in centuries, with resources and encouragement from the state. So how did they do all this in Russia? Well, it took the greatest flowering of democracy that the world had ever seen. Workers, soldiers, and peasants set up hundreds of unions, political parties, and social organizations all throughout the old Russian Empire. They set up thousands of Soviets or councils in order to try to control the society democratically themselves. However, by the late 1920s, things had completely changed in Russia. Stalin's first five-year plan brought forced collectivization and famine to the peasantry. The rights of women and minorities were rolled back. The working class, in whose name Stalin claimed to be ruling, were subjected to higher and higher levels of exploitation, productivity increases, and wage cuts. All trade unions and organizations independent of the state were crushed. All rights to democracy, speech, and protest were completely annulled. A decade after it had overthrown the old Tsar, the workers of Russia had come under the thumb of a new, far worse one, Stalin. Stalin was the butcher of the revolution. You know, far from creating socialism in Russia, Stalin reinstated a bureaucratic form of capitalism. And he did this by using the most brutal dictatorship that the world had ever seen up to that point. And this required the liquidation of all of the gains of the Russian Revolution. So how did it get to this point? Well, one of the core tenets of Marxism is that the working class is capable of taking democratic control of society and reshaping it in its own image. And the way that it does this, or one of the ways that it does this, is by taking over control of the means of production. It can then change how resources are distributed throughout society and effectively eliminate poverty. By eliminating the wants and needs of the masses, the working class can then liberate the rest of society. But what happens when it's impossible to provide for the basic needs of the masses? Indeed, what happens whenever the workers make a revolution and create a government in their own image, but then that the workers cease to exist as a class in any meaningful sense? This is the situation that Lenin and Trotsky and the fledgling workers' government found themselves in after they took power in Russia. So to start with, World War I decimated Russia. It had more casualties than any other country. The mass of peasants and workers were immiserated, and the economy was stretched to the breaking point as all of the resources of society were thrown into the war effort. When the Bolsheviks took power, they ended Russia's involvement in the war, and they gave land to the peasants, but they couldn't stop the economic collapse. Russian capitalism, this was exacerbated by the fact that Russian capitalism, which is backed by all the world's imperialist powers, then tried to overthrow the fledgling worker state and drown the revolution in blood. This led to a further 4 years of civil war for an already capital-starved, impoverished, and backwards Russia. The Russian economy entered what may have been, probably was, the most catastrophic economic collapse in human history. By February 1918, rations for metal workers in Moscow, which was then the capital of Russia, of the USSR, totaled only 300 calories per day, which was less than a tenth of what a manual worker needs to maintain a diet, a healthy diet. It would only get much worse from there. The suffering was just indescribable. Millions died from cold and hunger. There were reports of cannibalism. Typhus alone claimed 1.6 million lives in the 2 years after the revolution. Typhoid, dysentery, and cholera killed hundreds of thousands more. All told, 9 million people in Russia died, which was, at that point in time, 7% of the total population died from premature causes. In this environment, the concerns of the working class turned to basic survival. You can't really have meaningful democracy of any kind in circumstances like that, much less socialism. And that's demonstrated by the fact that during the NEP, which was the period immediately after the Civil War, meetings to do with food provisions, with the provisions of coal to heat your house and so on, were extremely well attended in the factories. Meetings discussing, you know, workers' control, world politics, democracy, culture, and so on, were not. But the economic crisis wasn't the only thing that the workers faced after the revolution. Pretty much as soon as it was formed, the fledgling revolutionary government came under assault from a terrifying fascist white army. The whites were not only against communism, they were against democracy of any kind. They massacred hundreds of thousands of Jews, of trade unionists, and pretty much anyone associated with the left anywhere that they were able to take control. They killed as many as 200,000 Jews in the Ukraine alone, which was the largest anti-Semitic massacre outside of the Holocaust. The ruling classes of Russia were no longer interested and compromising with the unruly workers and peasants. They strove to set up a reactionary fascist dictatorship on a mountain of corpses. Had the whites won, they would have been every bit as barbaric as Mussolini, Franco, and Hitler. But the whites didn't only enjoy the support of the capitalist class, they also received enormous amounts of money and weapons from the major imperialist powers. So by the end of 1918, more than 300,000 1918, you know, just in the year after the revolution, more than 300,000 foreign troops were in Russia from 14 different countries, including Britain, France, Germany, the United States, and even Australia. All of these armies were fighting the Bolsheviks. Countries that only recently finished slaughtering each other in Europe now put their differences aside to fight the real threat to their wealth and power, the Russian Revolution. So the fledgling workers' government won the civil war by an almost superhuman mobilization of the Russian masses. This effort, along with the catastrophic economic collapse, led to the decimation of the working class. So large-scale industrial production in 1920 was only 18% of that in 1913. Almost two-thirds of all the trains in Russia were completely out of action, and this is in the largest country on Earth. Hyperinflation reached such a point that in 1920, 90% of all of the workers in Moscow received their wages in kind. In other words, they didn't get paid money, they got paid cabbages and potatoes and other staple commodities, 90%. The mobilization of the war effort, cold, disease, and starvation drove people from the cities and the factories. So the population of Petrograd, which was, you know, the heartland of the revolution, fell from 2.4 million in 1917 to 570,000 in 1920. The number of industrial workers in Russia fell from 3 million in 1917 to 1.25 million in 1921 to 22, which is a decrease of 60%. But really, you know, if anything, these facts and stats actually underplay the decay and the destruction of the working class. Because what was left of the working class was disproportionately bled of its leading layers. Now, what do I mean by that? So anyone who's ever been involved in a strike or a protest or a campaign or an activist network who has ever tried to organize anything to, you know, workers to do anything on the job, has ever tried to basically organize any number of people to undertake any task at all, has probably figured this next bit out. In every room, there's usually a few leading people. They're the most outspoken and the most confident. They understand with the most clarity and foresight what we're doing and what needs to happen next. They're the people that everyone else looks to for a lead, and they're the people that everyone else respects. Well, this dynamic asserts itself even more during a period of revolution when millions of people are undertaking the project of reorganizing society as a whole. Millions of workers and peasants were enlisted in the new Red Army to fight the whites. But at the vanguard of this mobilization were the most self-sacrificing, the most class-conscious, militant, and politically radical sections of the working class. These leading elements were disproportionately, but not only, from the Bolshevik Party. They were the first to enlist, they were the most courageous and self-sacrificing soldiers on the front line, and thus they're the first to die. Any leading workers who didn't go to the army were needed to fill responsible positions in the revolutionary government. So in this way, the workplaces of Russia were emptied of the very people that formed the basis of workers' power in the first place. They were replaced by less experienced and politically conscious workers straight from the peasant farms. And these workers had no experience with socialism or democracy or the fight for revolution. They only hoped to keep their heads down and survive. So where does that leave us? Well, politics, like everything else in life and in nature, abhors a vacuum. The capitalist class and the czarist autocracy had been decisively smashed by the revolution and the Bolshevik victory in the Civil War. But the peasants, on the other hand, had pretty much had enough. They had their land, which was their main demand, and now they no longer had any interest in socialism or anything like it. But workers' power had been hollowed out by years of deprivation and war. So who was to fill this power vacuum? The answer, of course, was the state bureaucracy. As the Civil War escalated and the Russian economy collapsed, the states stepped in to try to hold things together. And really, this was out of necessity. Democracy of any kind, much less socialism, became impossible under such dire conditions. Factory managers, army officers, and state functionaries began to increase in importance as the active participation of the masses declined. At the same time, party membership grew massively, from a few tens of thousands at the time of the revolution to many millions within a few years. The few thousand of committed activists were at sea amongst millions of bureaucrats and party functionaries. And these people, their commitment to revolution was tenuous at best. This process took place over years, and initially the worker state was doing its best. But over time, this began to change. There's a really good book by Kevin Murphy, which follows one Moscow metal factory from the revolution all the way through the Stalinist counter-revolution. We don't actually have it here. I couldn't find it in the bookstore, but maybe you'd be lucky enough to find it out there. And it talks about the early years of the revolution, whenever workers really looked to party activists on the shop floor, Bolshevik party activists, and expected that they would be sympathetic to their demands, that they would fight so that they could have their grievances dealt with. They would represent them in negotiations with management and even with the government. But as Stalin rose to power, the nature of this party on the shop floor began to change as well. And pretty soon, rather than party activists being seen as sympathetic and leading layers, they began to be seen as, they were replaced with people who were seen as ones that said, like they're described as, quote, people who do nasty things, as embezzlers and thieves, as unprincipled bootlickers and informers. So that became the party apparatus on the shop floor rather than the revolutionary activists that people had known before. So as this state machine came to control the means of production in society, it began to see itself as the new elite, the new privileged class that was entitled to power. The bureaucracy was no longer interested in workers' revolution or workers' power. It was only interested in defending and deepening its control over society. Now, this process was obviously problematic enough, even when Lenin and Trotsky were still leading things. But for a while, their political principles were enough to sort of curb the worst excesses of this bureaucratic layer. But as things got worse, Trotsky and Lenin grew increasingly alarmed at the rise of Stalin, who was more and more obviously becoming the political champion of this bureaucracy. But Lenin died in 1924, just as he began the fight to depose Stalin from party leadership. Soon after that, Stalin pronounced it was possible to build socialism in Russia alone. He then defeated Trotsky with the backing of the majority of the state bureaucracy, who had given up on revolution or internationalism. Stalin then purged all opposition from the state, the party, and the Communist International, which was the International Organization of Communist Parties. Trotsky, who was, you know, keep in mind, was the leader of the October Revolution. He built the Red Army and was the leader of the Red Army. He was the hero of the revolution. Was expelled from the party and exiled from Russia in 1929. By this time, Stalin's dictatorship was complete. So the new Russian ruling class knew that in order to survive, it had to compete with the West, both economically and militarily. It therefore came under the same pressure to accumulate as capitalists in the West do. The only way that it could do this was by expropriating the peasantry and ramping up the exploitation of the working class to try to industrialize Russia. The bureaucracy provided Stalin with his power base in the party and in society more broadly. It gave him full dictatorial powers and like a grotesque personality cult to try to cement his power. In return, Stalin provided the bureaucracy with a political program and a leadership that was just as opportunistic, conservative, and ruthless as them. His dictatorship protected the interests of state capitalism in Russia and gave it legitimacy and expanded it abroad. Now, there's a couple myths that I want to deal with really quickly about Stalin. First of all, despite what some of you might have heard, he had very little talent. He wasn't a great organizer or a leader or a writer or a speaker or a theoretician in the way that Trotsky and Lenin and other leaders of the revolutionary left were. Really, his only significant work was on the national question, and that was ghostwritten by Lenin anyway. He had very little, he very rarely formed his own independent positions, and when he did, he was wrong. For example, before Lenin returned to Russia in April 1917, Stalin was for conciliation with the Mensheviks, basically talking about uniting with them, support for the bourgeois provisional government, and for continuing the First World War. He played a minor role in the Russian Revolution, in the Bolshevik Party, and in the Comintern before the early 1920s. He viewed ideas pragmatically. He considered winning and losing to be far more important than getting to the truth. He was a cunning maneuverer, and he was ruthless, and he had a flexible relationship with political principle, to put it mildly. All of those qualities made him a very mediocre revolutionary, but they perfectly equipped him to oversee an authoritarian dictatorship. The bureaucracy saw nothing of itself in Trotsky's brilliant theories and calls for international revolution. They had their champion in the dull, gray, conservative, unprincipled, and ruthless Stalin. As Trotsky said, Stalin didn't create the state bureaucracy. The state bureaucracy created him. There's another myth that I want to deal with quickly, that Stalin arose from the problems inherent in the Bolshevik Party. And on one level, this is much more serious. According to this, Stalinism was only the practical application of Marxist ideas. But despite what we're commonly told, Stalin actually had no use for the genuine ideas of Marxism. By the time he came to power, he only used Marxism or, you know, history and ideas in general, for that matter. He only used them only insofar as they could be warped into a state religion that might overawe and discipline the masses. Although it was superficially coded in Marxist phraseology, Stalinism actually represented the complete negation of Marxism. One example of this is, again, the theory of socialism in one country. There was no historical precedence of this theory in the Marxist canon. No one, including Engels, Marx, Lenin, or even Stalin himself before 1923, thought it was possible to build socialism in one country. It was taken for granted by literally every preceding Marxist that socialism could only be created through international revolution. And it only got worse from there. In the coming years, Stalin's theory and strategy would lead the international left from one disaster to another. And this wasn't an accident. Where genuine Marxism sought to promote rebellion from below, Stalinism did everything it could to sabotage it. After all, an international revolution would be just as much of a threat to Stalin as it was to Western capitalism. To say that Stalin is founded on the principles of Marxism It's kind of like saying the U.S. empire is founded on the principles of freedom and democracy. It's a sick joke that only the naive and ill-informed can be expected to believe, or, you know, right-wingers. And really, you know, to say that a notion of blood separates Stalinism from Marxism would be a vast understatement. Yes, Lenin and the Bolsheviks during the Civil War were reduced to resorting to violence. But the violence under the Bolsheviks was of a completely different quantity and quality to that of the White Armies, much less Stalinism. So according to Major General William S. Greaves, who commanded the U.S. forces against the Bolsheviks in Siberia, he said, quote, "There are horrible murders committed, but they are not committed by the Bolsheviks as the world believes. I am well on the side of safety when I say that anti-Bolsheviks killed 100 people in eastern Siberia for every one killed by the Bolsheviks." And according to Kornilov, who was a very important figure in the White Armies, he said, quote, "The greater the terror, the greater our victories. We must save Russia, even if we have to set fire to half the country and shed the blood of three-fourths of Russians." And Stalin, in turn, murdered millions of Russians in the forced collectivization and industrialization. Millions more starved while Stalin exported grain abroad to increase state revenues. And, you know, other state capitalist regimes all over Europe and Africa and Asia murdered millions more for the sake of their own power and profit, all while using the methods pioneered by Stalin, not by Lenin. It's doubtful that Marx and Lenin could even have conceived of violence and authoritarianism on this scale, much less endorsed it. Indeed, Stalinism and Leninism were opposites in every way. Where Lenin and the Bolsheviks helped to overthrow capitalism, Stalin reinstated it. Where the Bolsheviks boasted a strong tradition of supporting women and the rights of minorities, Stalin reinforced the subjugation of women and the domination of minorities at the hands of the Russian state. The Comintern under Lenin and Trotsky strove at all costs to lead workers to power internationally. Under Stalin, the Comintern did everything it could to destroy the possibility of international revolution. But Stalin didn't just snuff out the revolution by destroying the ideas of Marxism. He had to physically liquidate it as well. By 1940, every leading Bolshevik who was involved in the Russian Revolution was purged or imprisoned in show trials and then murdered. This isn't hyperbole, every single one. Likewise, as the communist movement abroad was Stalinized, anyone with a modicum of radicalism or talents or even independent thought was purged from communist parties internationally. If Stalin's USSR was actually Marxist, why would he feel the need to eliminate anyone who might conceivably adhere to genuine Marxism? The answer, of course, is that Stalinism was a complete refutation of everything that Marx and Lenin actually stood for. So, if Stalin was the defeat of the revolution, how could the revolution have won? Well, the answer to this question isn't going to be found within the borders of Russia itself. As I mentioned before, well, before Stalin, Marxists argued that socialism was only possible on an international basis. Any revolution will inevitably confront the interconnectedness of the world economy, the international nature of the working class, and violent opposition from the imperialist powers. For revolution to succeed anywhere, ultimately it has to succeed everywhere. Now, nowhere is this truer than in Tsarist Russia, which was the most economically and politically backward country in Europe at the time. Russia had some of the most advanced industry in the cities, you know, in the world, in their cities for sure. But its working class only totaled a few million. The vast majority of its 150 million people were peasants. There was no advanced agriculture. You know, most people relied on mules and hand tools to plow, plant, and harvest their crops. You know, just to give you a sense of things, the average income per head in Russia in 1917 was 20% lower than the average income per head in Britain in 1688, more than two centuries earlier. And that was the state of the country even before, sorry, that was in 1913, excuse me. And that was the state of the country even before the First World War. After years of imperialist war, revolution, and civil war, Russia was utterly ruined. The working class was decimated numerically, organizationally, and politically. The population was destitute. And the peasantry, which made up the vast majority of Russia, grew increasingly hostile to the revolution after they'd won the land. Meanwhile, the Soviet government grew more authoritarian and bureaucratic as it became more isolated. Any idea that it was possible to build socialism in Russia alone was completely laughable. But that was never the intention of Lenin or Trotsky. They predicted that a successful revolution in Russia would spread throughout Europe. Really, they saw the Russian Revolution as a detonator that would ignite a global revolutionary conflagration. This would give the Russian Revolution relief as it gained access to the advanced industry and technique from the West. It would have then been possible to rebuild the Russian economy and rebuild the living standards of the working class and thus their political combativity and consciousness and organization. This reborn proletariat could have disciplined and eventually overcome the bureaucratization of the state. But an international revolution wouldn't only have lifted Russia out of poverty, it would have created the conditions for overcoming the key pillars of international capitalism: economic exploitation, the market, and the nation state. Only on this basis would real democracy and liberation have been possible in Russia. Now, all this might sound like a pipe dream now, but at the time, there were real prospects that this might happen. The First World War ended when Europe was swept with a wave of revolutions. Centuries-old monarchies were toppled, empires crumbled, and workers everywhere, inspired by the Russian Revolution, struck and set up Soviets to try to take over society themselves. Outside of the United States, Germany was the most economically advanced country in the world. It had an enormously powerful industrial working class. A successful revolution there would have placed Germany at the center of the global socialist movement and opened up the real prospects for revolution across Europe and in the world. Meanwhile, a German revolution could have come to the aid of the Russian Revolution, providing advanced industrial and agricultural equipment with which Russia could have peacefully modernized and lifted itself out of poverty, allowing workers to begin to regain control over their society. If the revolution had been successful in another country, and it was very close in Germany, Stalin may well have been resigned to the margins of history, which is exactly where he belongs. Unlike Russia, however, no other proletariat had a mass organization like the Bolsheviks that was willing and able to lead them to power. The workers were repeatedly betrayed by the reformist leaders, and their struggles were crushed by state repression and fascist gangs. In 1923, the revolutions and turmoil finally receded after 5 years. In Germany, you know, as a side note, the key people to defeat the revolution were actually the ones that would today call themselves democratic socialists. So if just one of these revolutions had succeeded in breaking through, the entire history of both Russia and the world could have turned out completely differently. Rather than the barbarism of the Great Depression, Stalin, Hitler, World War II, and the Cold War, we might have seen a century of victorious revolutions, flowering democracy, and as Marx once described socialism, the real beginning of human history. So just to begin to conclude, Victor Serge, who we've got one of his books here on the Russian Revolution's beautiful account, he's a former anarchist who was won to Bolshevism after he moved to Russia after the revolution. And he described Stalin, you know, really well. He said, quote, "It's often said that the germ of Stalinism was in Bolshevism at its beginning. Well, I have no objection to that. Only Bolshevism also contains many other germs, a mass of other germs. And those who lived through the enthusiasm of the first years of the victorious socialist revolution ought not forget it. To judge a living man by the death germs which the autopsy reveals in the corpse, and which he may have carried in him since his birth, is that very sensible." So what did Serge mean by this? Well, history is most commonly taught with an air of inevitability. Revolutions will inevitably fail, and Stalins will inevitably come to power. But certain periods of history are pregnant with possibility. Those periods are revolutions. They lift human consciousness to ever higher planes, and they throw huge social forces into struggle. And this can quickly flip any given historical circumstance or set of circumstances into their exact opposites. The Russian Revolution opened up a historic period of immense possibility. One of those possibilities was the defeat of the revolution and the isolation of the revolution and its destruction at the hands, the corpse hands, as Victor Serge called it, of Stalin. But that wasn't the only possibility. Worldwide socialist revolution was very much on the agenda. And had anyone else succeeded in doing what Lenin and the Bolsheviks did, the ailing Russian Revolution might have sprung back to life. Despite overwhelming odds, Lenin and Trotsky fought with incredible courage and determination to defend the gains of the revolution and try to spread it abroad. Indeed, they gave their lives for this cause. Of course, they made mistakes and they're ultimately defeated, but their record is completely unblemished by the cynical opportunism of Stalin. You know, I think we owe a particular debt to Trotsky. Stalin did everything he could to snuff out the real Marxist tradition. And in doing this, he was aided by the full weight of the global ruling class. But even with all the odds in his favor, he couldn't fully succeed. And we largely have the indefatigable Trotsky to thank for that. His devotion to defending the genuine Marxist tradition through what has been called the midnight of the century left us with a rich revolutionary tradition. Thanks to people like Trotsky and Lenin, we have the true history of the Russian Revolution, which stands as the pinnacle, still stands as the pinnacle of emancipatory achievement. This history furnishes us with many of the political, theoretical, and strategic tools that we need to transform our world today. But those tools are no use just sitting on a bookshelf. We have to put them to use today, which is exactly what Socialist Alternative is trying to do. Thank you.